podcast that brings you one guest, one question, one answer. Business insights in minutes, not hours, with your host, the small business and franchise expert, Gary Occhiogrosso.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Mastermind Minutes. My name is Gary Occhiogrosso. I am the founder and managing partner for Franchise Growth Solutions. And as you know, you can learn about Franchise Growth Solutions by hitting our website. That's this big poster in back of us. And you can learn about what we do. Mastermind Minutes, for those of you who are joining us for the very first time, is a very simple concept of a webcast, podcast, depending how you're watching or listening. We typically have one guest. We discuss one topic. We get one answer. We do it in minutes, not hours. And as we always say, we know that is a bit of a tease. So at the end of the program, we will definitely give you contact information for our guest in the event you would like to contact him directly and find out more about what he does and services that he may be able to provide for you. So today, my guest is Devin Miller, and he is the founder and CEO of Miller IP Law. In addition, Devin has founded several multi-million dollar startups himself and continues to found, manage, and grow several startups and small businesses. Devin has been working with startups and small businesses for 7+ years at this point. He's helped startups and small businesses protect and grow their business in industries such as wearables, medical devices, bicycles, boat anchors, mason jars that I want to know about, microprocessors, and many, many more. Having worked with numerous startups and been through the startup process himself, Devin knows the ups and downs and the highs and lows and the successes and failures that startups face, which we've talked about many times in this program. Devin is also the host of his own podcast, The Inventive Journey, where he discusses the journey that startups and small businesses take on their path to success. So Devin, good morning and welcome. And thank you very much for being here. Before we get into the question, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself? Because that's a very brief bio, and what you've been doing these days, what's new and exciting in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and thank you for the great intro. It makes, you know, whenever you have somebody else introduce yourself, it makes you feel a lot more important than you really are. So that was a great intro. But no, so a little bit more about myself. I always pride myself first and foremost as a father and a husband. So I've been married for 13 years to college sweetheart. We did go to the same high school, but we didn't know each other in high school until we got to college. I also am father of four. So I have four kids from the ages 5 to 10, three girls and a boy. And so that always keeps me busy. And then I said, I love, as you probably caught in the intro, I love startups. I love small businesses. Started my first startup, real startup, when I was in MBA school. I was doing a law degree and an MBA degree. So I have 4 degrees, which my wife always says is 3 degrees too many. So I got electrical engineering degree, Mandarin Chinese, a law degree, and then a MBA, or Master's of Business Administration. So between all of those, I went to a decent amount of schooling and had did a lot of things in the meantime. And then more recently, founded Miller IP Law, where, as you mentioned, we help startups and small businesses with their patents and trademarks. And if they ever need help, just to throw it out to your audience, they can go to strategymeeting.com, and that's an easy way to connect up with me and chat more about anything we talk about on this podcast. Great.
And we'll kind of restate that later on. Well, you know, in the pond that I play in, which when we did our kind of initial call, you know, I'm in the franchise development business, and most of my clients, not all, but most of them are startups and emerging brands. And one of the things that we get into when we take on a company, especially if they are taking their individual owned and operated company, we do a lot of restaurants, so let's say a pizza shop, and they want to franchise it, very often we find that they lack the corporate structure. They don't know how to protect their intellectual property. They may have a name that 100 other people are using. They haven't secured the URL on their, maybe they think their Facebook page is their website. So what I'm getting at is that when it comes to intellectual property and more digital assets, which a lot of companies, especially startups, they don't view their digital piece of their company as an asset. I do. I think it's a huge asset. How do startups protect their intellectual property? And then And we'll kind of go on with it. But then what do they need to do to kind of maintain or change as they grow as a company? But why don't we start with what are the basics that a company needs to know and do in order to protect their intellectual property, both, you know, visually and digitally?
Yeah, so maybe as a good level set and definitely answer your question is I would define a little bit what is intellectual property for those of people. Yeah. A lot of times you hear the word on whether a Shark Tank or a business podcast or anything else, and you kind of have an idea, but you don't really know. So simple is intellectual property is an umbrella term. So it kind of encapsulates a few different things, and that includes patents. Patents are really for invention, something that does something, has a functionality. It also includes trademarks. So something with your brand, a name of a company, name of a logo, name of a product, something of that nature. Incorporates copyrights, which are really on the creative nature. So painting, a book, a movie, a podcast, or whatever it is, all of those really fall into intellectual property. And then there are kind of some adjacent terms, which you kind of mentioned, or LLCs, business formations, or NDAs, or non-disclosure agreements, those type of things. Now, going to your question, kind of with that as a level set, really, when you look at a business, every business is different as to how you go about protecting your intellectual property, because no two businesses are the same. And where I would start is if you're looking to protect it is what is the core, what's the value of your business? Meaning, is it your brand? Are you the next Nike? Are you the next Starbucks? Are you the next M&M's or Coca-Cola or something that's a big brand name and that's what you're looking for? And a lot of times that's what a franchise is, right? You think of McDonald's, you think of Burger King, you think of any franchise, a lot of their value is tied up in a brand. So you're going to go for a trademark. On the other hand, if you're making the next best iPhone or the next best widget or whatever it is, then where your value is a lot on the intellectual property for the patent side. The actual thing that you're making is where your value is. So when you're starting out as a startup, small business, or any phase, you're going to first thing you do is you step back and say, where is the value of my business? Where do I want to protect? If somebody were to come along, knock it off, copy it, or otherwise, you know, do something similar, would that hurt? Would there be an ouch factor? And if the answer is yes, that's where you start going about protecting your business.
Yeah, and that makes perfectly good sense. Now, you've broken it up into a lot of different pieces. Again, in the franchise side, again, just because I'm familiar with it, you know, when we do what's known as an FDD, a franchise disclosure document, so we'll work with the client and their attorney. You know, one of the things they need to have is a federally registered trademark. Mm-hmm. So is that something that you would recommend to your clients, like right out of the box? Should I federally register my trademark, whether I'm going to franchise or not? Does that help in protecting the asset?
I would say 90% of the time, yes. And I'll give you the caveat first as to why it would be a no, and then everything else is a yes. If you are going to be a mom and pop shop, and I think they're awesome, no problem with them at all. But if your intention is really just, hey, I want to serve the local community. I just want to serve the people around me. I have a small restaurant. I have no intention of franchising or building anything. I just want to have a small business I can run in the local area. Probably doesn't make sense to trademark it in the sense that you're not going to get a return on the value because you're not going to grow that brand or do anything with it. But on the other hand, as you're saying, hey, our intent is at some point, and it'll take maybe years or a period of time, at least we have the opportunity, the option that we're going to grow this or expand it multiple locations or do something else on that nature, then I would do it fairly early. And the main reason I would do it earlier, and kind of you said, as you're setting it up, first I'd set up an LLC because one, that way the corporation owns everything, and two, it shields you from personal liability. But the second thing is figure out what your brand is and then make sure to protect it. Because where a lot of times I see it is I'll get companies that walk in and they'll be doing business for a few years. And then they'll come in and say, okay, we finally got to a stage that we should probably get a trademark on this, or we've been thinking about it and protecting it. And then we'll go through and we'll see what other people have done, what other trademarks have been registered. Come to find out somebody else has already registered that either before them or even after them, but got it first. And now they're looking at, okay, what do? We've spent all this time, money, and effort building a brand, building a company, and now do we have to rebrand? Do we have to try and go get a license? Do we have to try and go and buy it? Do we have to try and explore other? And it limits their options, and all of those options are a lot more expensive. So usually, do your bit of your due diligence, look at what brand is available, and then I would protect it much earlier on.
Right, okay, and I get it on brands that are growing. And let me give you a real-world scenario. You know, as for those of us who are my age, I'm 63, we remember a show called Dragnet. And they would have this little opening. And at the end, it was a crime show. They would say the names have been changed to protect the innocent. So the names won't be true here. But we have Joe's Donuts. Okay. Single unit guy, operates in a town of about 25,000 people, wildly successful. Everybody goes to Joe's Donuts. And I decide I'm going to open up a donut shop on the other side of town, and I'm going to call it Joe's Donuts 2, or Joey's Donuts, or Joe's Donut Place. And my intention, well, not admittedly, but my intention may be to somehow convince consumers that I have something to do with the very famous Joe's, and he only has one location, but he's really famous in our town. What can Joe, who owns the original Joe's Donut, do if he hasn't protected his name in any way?
First of all, hurry and run and get a trademark is what I would do. But, you know, let's say he doesn't have a trademark and he's trying to explore his options. So you do have what's called common law rights, or, you know, rights are inherent by using a brand. And those are called common law. And basically, the difference is with those rights, you establish them, assuming you're the first person. So first is we have to assume that Joe is the first one. You know, the original Joe's Donuts was the first one to come up with that name for that area. If not, then he doesn't have any rights either. But assuming he does, then he has rights to his brand within the geographic location that he's operating. So let's say that was in, I'll make it up, Detroit or Chicago or whatever it was. Is if he had been owning and operating and selling under Joe's Donuts, he was the first one, he would have the rights to use that brand within that geographic location. Now, how do you define geographic location? That's a bit harder. Does that mean that Joe's Donuts is famous in a 10-mile radius, or is that the whole city, or is that the whole state? And you'd have to go and define where your customers are, how well-known you are, and how far of a reach you've done in sales. But if you could say, okay, for the Chicago as a city, I can establish that, then he can stop Joe's Donuts 2, or whatever you want to call it, from going there because he does have those common law rights. Now, the flip side is anything outside. Now, let's say that rather than having Joe's Donuts 2 in Chicago, they went over to LA because everybody knew about Joe's Donuts. They even heard about it in LA, but Joe's Donuts original never sold anything in LA. They hadn't done anything in LA. They just had a great reputation. Well, then they can't stop Joe's Donuts 2 from doing anything in LA because it's not where they've sold in their geographic location. Right. So you're limited if you're going common law rights to be in your geographic location. And if Joe's Donuts 2 were to file the federal registration first, then anything outside of Chicago, Joe's Donuts 2 owns, and Joe's Donuts 2, or Joe's Donuts original can only stay in Chicago. They can't expand anymore.
Okay, so let me just try to unravel that a little bit for a layman like myself and probably Absolutely. The vast majority of our audience. So I get it. If Joe's original was the first guy doing it, and he can somehow prove that, maybe he has a menu that was printed in 1975, or he incorporated or LLC'd his business way back when, and he can say, hey, I've been using this since 1980, and I'm the first guy in. Okay, so that's fine. However, it would appear to me that at some point, being able to demonstrate that and make that presentation, if you will, to, I'm assuming, a judge, would require legal fees. So are those legal fees equal to or near the amount that Joe might have spent just trademarking his marks in the beginning and just being done with it? Or I realize that's kind of a crystal ball question because you don't know how much Joe's going to push back.
Definitely cheaper to register, meaning he's probably anywhere from at the very lowest end, 50x upwards to 100 or 200x the cost
to protect. Right. Yep. Okay. So I think the takeaway from this section of the conversation is if you have a business, even if it's a mom and pop and it costs you a couple grand to hire an attorney and get a trademark, just do it because you don't know what the future holds. You know, the other piece there is you may never have an idea to expand the business, but maybe it's a legacy brand that you pass down to your children and all of a sudden they want to blow it up, only to find out that Joe's Donuts 2 has actually registered the trademark in everywhere else but your little town, USA. So for me, I'm not talking about being over legal or spending money where money doesn't need to be spent. But I think because none of us really know what the future holds or what people are capable of doing, if there's a simple method like just registering your marks, just go and do it. It's a cost of doing business. That to me is the takeaway.
I think that's a great takeaway, and I absolutely agree. And to your point, even if you, let's say you get to the point of retirement and you're just going to sell off your company, they're going to want to know all of the value, what you've protected, and they may have plans, as you mentioned, to grow this in from a small or local place to a much bigger thing, and then they're going to much greater devalue your company if they can't grow it. So
yeah, and I can tell you, and that's an interesting point, that kind of slingshots us into maybe the next level of this question or this topic. Although there's a couple of other things that I definitely want to get to. The you know, in my firm, when we scale a brand up, and not just in my firm, I mean in the franchising industry in general, the franchising space for the last, certainly the last 10 years, and in particular the last 5 years, is on fire with private equity firms. I mean, they come in and they go, hey, wait a minute now. I don't want to own a group of restaurants that I have to run. And maybe the EBITDA line, you know, I'm only going to offer you a 3 or 4 multiple on that because, gee, I got a lot of money on the street. I got a lot of people I got to take care of. It's a pain in the neck. But now I see this franchise company and their EBITDA line, their profit is driven by royalties, which are basically mailbox money that the franchisees have to send to the franchisor for the rights to continue to use the name. And they go, wow, this is scalable endlessly, a very flat organization. You still need people, but I don't need 30 people in a restaurant. With 30 people, I can probably oversee 100 franchisees. So what happens is they come in and they look at all the assets because that's what they're purchasing. And sometimes, obviously, the trademarks are obvious, but let's talk about things that maybe are hidden assets or things that people don't normally think of as assets. And what I'll use as an example in the franchising business are things like operations manuals, which carry proprietary procedures. And in the food business, perhaps proprietary specialized recipes. Should those manuals and recipes, would they be copyrighted? Like, how would you protect that?
Yeah, and I think that was the one I was going to do is recipes are one of the best. If you're to think of one of the biggest brands, Coca-Cola, supposedly, at least the story goes, there's only 2 pump people within the company that ever know the recipe at the same time. So if one of them passes on, they actually have a ceremony that they give this recipe to the second person. So there's a lot, and same thing with Mrs. Phil's cookies. A lot of them, so you can, there's a few different ways, and I'll tell you the typical way. Sometimes you can patent it. Sometimes it's if you have a special combination of ingredients that make something new and creative and inventive, you can patent it, and there are some food patents out there. That's kind of the one option. Another one is to copyright it. So if you're saying, hey, I want to copyright it, I want to be able to protect. So here's a list of ingredients. Here's how you go about making it. We put it in a user's manual and we go about doing that. You can copyright it. So that's a typical route. Some of the bigger companies, they'll keep it as a trade secret. So the one we talked about, Coca-Cola, Mrs. Fields Cookie, they keep it under lock and key. Very few people know the recipe. It's very secretive and with good reason, because once a secret gets out, everybody knows they can start knocking it off and you lose your lot of value. So if you're a typical company, you're probably under copyrights to protect the recipe, the steps, the amounts, and the measurements. If you're going to want to, the only problem with the copyright is everybody gets to know about it, right? When you copyright it, you have to register it. People can go look up the registration. So if you really have something special you want to keep secret, then you go to a trade secret. But trade secrets, you have to keep secretive. As soon as they get out, doesn't really matter how they get out. It's cats out of the bag and you lose your ability to protect them.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, again, I see a lot of tripwires there. By the way, for those of you who've just joined us, we are speaking with Devin Miller from Miller Law. And we are talking about protecting your intellectual property. I guess one of the things that struck me when you were just talking about trade secret versus patent versus copyright, again, being a layman, if I were to patent a piece of machinery that makes, I don't know, my tacos or something, okay? Doesn't the patent eventually run out? Isn't there a shelf life for a patent? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so patents expired. So two things with patents. One is you have to disclose everything. So if you get a patent, you have to tell them everything, how it works, where or what you do. And so that's always a trade-off. In the one sense, you get a basically what's a 20-year monopoly. So 20 years from the time you originally filed the patent, you get the exclusive rights to make, manufacture, produce, sell, whatever it is you patented. Trade-off is you have to tell all the information, all the details of what it is that you're patenting. And so at the end of those 20 years, people can build on top of it. So there is a bit of that trade-off. You get the exclusivity for 20 years. After the 20 years, anybody can do it.
Okay. So there's a limited shelf life on that. Got it. Okay. Kind of, I don't want to switch gears, but talking about kind of the expansion of protecting the asset. My understanding is, and I had this unfortunately happen to me, I didn't own it. I was the president of a company, that it was an ice cream company, and their name, when we went into another state, we found out someone was using the name. And what we later found out, because we had purchased this company and apparently the due diligence wasn't as sharp as it should have been, what we later found out was that they only registered the name in the category of, I think, frozen dessert or ice cream. And this other company, they were doing restaurants, bars, and wearables. And we thought, well, you know, that was a lesson learned for me. Like, so if I register my mark and I'm, let's say, you know, Joe's Donuts, but I want to sell Joe's Donuts baseball caps and sweatshirts online, I need to protect that in that category, correct? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great example. So, you know, the one I always use and kind of along with Joe's Donuts, Nike. Everybody knows Nike, right? They have athletic wear, apparel, sports gear. And so they have a ton of trademarks for those types of goods and services. They don't have a trademark for Nike Automotive, for automobiles. And in fact, this is a Easter egg for your audience. If they ever go to NikeAuto.com, I've actually gone and registered Nike Automotive just to make the point of that you can actually go and do it for other goods and services, because the way it works is you can only get a trademark for the types of goods and services that you're actually using. So in Joe's ice cream, he can only, if he's only doing a restaurant, or let's say he's only selling ice cream, meaning he's a distributor or a provider to other restaurants, then he's not in the restaurant business. You can't go get a trademark for something that you're not doing. Now you can, if you intend to use it, if you're going to use it in the near future, you can still secure it. But if you don't have the intent, you're not going to do it, you're not able to. So there are different categories that you can file a trademark on. When you file it, you have to say, here's how I intend to use it. I'm Nike. I'm going to use it for sports gear. I'm Joe's ice cream. I'm going to sell ice cream. I'm whatever. I'm going to sell this or do this. And that's how you start to categorize trademarks.
Right. And so that's definitely a question that a startup or an emerging brand should ask or have with their attorney, that, you know, hey, how am I going to use this? I need to protect all of that. Okay. Last question. And certainly then, as I said, we'll kind of give your contact info again. As a company grows, what should they be doing to kind of revisit? Because I know it's not a one and done. What should they be looking at? An example for me, but certainly feel free to add to it, is I know I have many concepts where over the years they've freshened up or changed their logo, or they've come up with a new slogan or something. And when I look at their trademarks, when we go to enter it into their FDD, they may have logos in there from 10 years ago that they no longer use, but they keep renewing. So tell us a little bit about kind of protecting existing assets and then maybe revisiting current assets and going, hey, you know what? My company is now this big and I need to do this.
Yeah, I think that to your point, what it's usually when you look at intellectual property, it's going to be a portfolio. So to your point, it's not a one and done, because 99.9% of the companies, if you're staying in business, you're going to continue to build and grow and expand, right? And that could be everything from you're going to continue to brand things, to your point, new catchphrases, you're building new products, you're building new services, you're going into expanding into different verticals, whatever that is. And so, you know, a good practice is probably about once a year, you know, somewhere along that lines, is to come back, revisit kind of what you've done over the last year, preferably probably once you revisit, go sit down with an attorney and say, here's the update. there. And if you haven't changed anything, that's an easy revisit. You just continue on with what you're doing. But if you're rolling out new products, new brands, new services, going into different verticals, sit down once a year with your attorney and say, here's what we've done. What would you recommend, or what would you strategize? Because you're going to want to build a portfolio. I always look at intellectual properties. It's incredibly difficult to account for every possible circumstance of everything you could ever need to protect. And nobody's going to want to spend that much money. Right. But what you're trying to do is protect the value of your company. And I always look at it as kind of a minefield, right? So you're trying to build a minefield, and minefield with enough time, money, and effort, you can navigate through a minefield and get to the other side. What you're trying to do is, it's so difficult, takes so long, takes so much money, takes so much effort, that they'd rather not go through the minefield, and that keeps your competitors at bay. So you're trying to build that portfolio to build the minefield such that they'd either just acquire you, they'd like to take a license from you, or they just simply don't get going from the get-go.
Yeah, and it makes sense. And sometimes I'll have clients say to me, how can I remember all of this? You know, and I say, listen, it's real simple. It's whatever today's date is. It's January 1st, okay? So what I want you to do is revisit your IP, talk to your attorney, and go to your Outlook calendar and set up a repeating message every year that it pops up to say, hey, look at your IP and what you have to do. Okay. So look, the conversation here, as far as I'm concerned, has been fascinating. I think it's the type of help that people who are in small businesses and startups really need. I always tell my clients, you know, don't try to, you know, circumvent or come up with a workaround for a legal issue, because you usually end up on the short end of the stick, as they say. And it usually ends up costing you more money. Just to remind our audience, we've been talking with Devin Miller, who is the founder and CEO of Miller IP Law. Devin, if people want to reach out to you, what is the best way to do that? Keeping in mind that we will also post that information on the text in the podcast, but how can people reach you?
Yeah. So easiest way, if people have questions, they want to chat a bit more, they want to strategize and get a bit more of a personalized strategy for them, they can go to strategymeeting.com, and that links to my calendar. You can set up a day and time right there. We'll have a one-on-one conversation, kind of go through any questions you have and everything else. If they just want to find out more about the law firm, or more about, you know, kind of our pricing structure, about us and what we do, they can go to lawwithmiller.com. So you want to reach out to me, strategymeeting.com. You want to learn a little bit more about the firm, lawwithmiller.com.
Great, great. Last thing, where can we find the podcast, the name of it again, and where do we find it?
Yeah, so podcast is The Inventive Journey, and you can really find it about every platform. So Spotify, that's a website building, but Stitcher, iHeart, Google Play, or all those, Apple, iTunes, you know, all those. Just search in The Inventive Journey. You can also watch the video. We capture that. You can do that on YouTube or on our website. So anyway, if you search The Inventive Journey, it's going to pop up in your first Google search results.
Excellent. Great. Thank you so much for being with us. This has been insightful, fascinating, and I'm sure very helpful to a lot of the folks that watch the webcast and listen to the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I truly, truly appreciate it. We have to have you back on a different topic.
All right. I appreciate you having me on. I'm always happy to come back and chat more.
All right. Bye.